WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latte from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and our online video picks for this week are up on our website. This week's picks include Barack Obollywood, an Obama mashup in the style of a Bollywood movie. See our online video picks at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Well, Charles Ferguson's documentary, No End in Sight, maybe you saw it, focuses on key policy decisions during the 2 to 3 month period following the invasion of Iraq in the spring of 2003. Though the film was released 6 months ago, Ferguson continues to investigate, speaking with public figures who he was not able to interview in time for the film. One of those people happens to be Bernard Kerik, our recently indicted former New York City police chief, who also served as interim minister of the interior in Iraq during early 2003. Charles Ferguson's latest interviews are going to be compiled in a book, also called No End in Sight, to be released early next year by Public Affairs. We'll play a couple of clips here, and he joins us now to talk about his book, his conversation with Kerik, and how he sees things in Iraq today. Charles Ferguson, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
Now, did you try to interview Bernard Kerik for the initial documentary?
We did not. He signaled, actually, that he would be willing to be interviewed for the original documentary. And with some regret, I have to say, I decided that we wouldn't put him in.
Because he wasn't a credible enough figure, or it just was not the most interesting material?
It just at the time did not seem to be the most important thing, and films can only be so long and all that.
So we're going to play a clip in a minute from your interview subsequently with Bernard Kerik. When did this take place?
Very recently, about a month ago.
Was that after he was indicted?
No, it was 1 week before he was indicted.
All right. Now, this hasn't been broadcast anywhere before, I don't believe, and it's just raw tape from your chat with him. So, listeners, the sound quality is not great, but this is interesting. This is what Kerik had to say about trying to reconstitute the Iraqi police force and figure out who would be allowed to join the new national police.
A lot of people they put out this criticism about the vetting process and having, because there was corruption within the police at a later point in time. I don't think anybody understood at the time it was to vet these guys was nearly impossible. There were no databases. There was no intelligence. There was no way to determine who was who. And at some point in time, probably the second or third week of June, as we were recalling the police, we were doing it by radio. I had them go on the radio stations, the Iraqis, the senior Iraqis, go on the radio stations and start calling people back to work. And everybody started reporting to the academy.
So Kerik says in that clip that to vet these guys was nearly impossible. And to be clear, this was part of his admittedly very difficult job, right? To vet people, to find a loyal police force.
Yes, a loyal, competent, honest, non-brutal, effective police force. Very hard thing to do in Iraq in 2003.
And later on this tape, Kerik describes to you how he came to be hired by Donald Rumsfeld. And it sounds like a real whirlwind courtship. He got a call by the White House liaison for the Pentagon the first week of May. By May 18th, 2003, he was in Kuwait. Journalist Michael Moss described Rumsfeld's people as being basically like, great, you're our guy. Can you be there in 10 days? Moss also goes on to say that Kerik prepared for his new job by watching A&E documentaries on Saddam Hussein.
Correct.
This is, you know, it's a Keystone Cops moment, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah. It's quite amazing that somebody would be appointed to be in charge of the entire police force and Interior Ministry of Iraq in that way.
And as we mentioned, your documentary really focuses on those first few months. And one of the key decisions was to not establish martial law. So here's another exchange from your tape of the Kerik interview.
Did you ever talk to Bremer or to the military people or both and say, you know, look, this country's in chaos, declare martial law?
No. And I think the reason, I mean, I guess I could have recommended it. I wouldn't have been the one to, I think probably at the time it was when I first got there, I guess Slocum would have been the one to do something like that, but I don't think anybody recommended it.
Do you think Kerik was actually in a position to recommend martial law?
Yes, he absolutely was. He wasn't in a position to establish it. That would have had to have been done by the senior military commanders, but he was certainly in a position to recommend it, and it was indeed his job to make such decisions.
Looking back and having done all this research on the first few months, do you think that martial law would have been a good idea? Most Americans hear martial law, especially people who tend to be anti-war, and they go, martial law, what an authoritarian thing for the United States to do.
Oh, I think it was imperative to establish martial law in Iraq in April and May 2003. You have to understand this is a society that had been deeply brutalized. The Americans come in, they take over the place. 6 months before, Saddam Hussein had released every common criminal from Iraqi prisons, 100,000 common criminals. He had given many of them weapons when he did that, arming them in the hope that they would cause the Americans trouble. And Baghdad in May of 2003 was in chaos. The murder rate had gone up to 700 to 1,000 murders a month, and the place... Everybody had automatic weapons. All the banks were robbed. Every major building was looted and stripped and burned. Baghdad was in chaos. It was anarchy.
And I remember the coverage we were doing even on the very day in April that year that the statue fell, considered the emblematic day that the Saddam Hussein regime fell. Even then, the looting was taking place and was being reported side by side with the fall of Saddam Hussein. And... shortly thereafter, Donald Rumsfeld made that now infamous remark about something to the effect of, this is what happens when you get freedom after years of being cooped up by a totalitarian.
Yes. Yes. The failure of the United States to declare martial law and more generally the failure of the United States to establish order in Iraq and prevent the destruction of the country and prevent its descent into anarchy and crime and chaos in mid-2003, I think, was the first and perhaps largest mistake of the American occupation.
Which allowed the insurgency also to take hold. But even at the level of just street chaos, that was always an amazing remark by Rumsfeld, equating freedom with looting. But you have said that you found Kerik to have a practical street sense that was impressive. Do you get the sense, after interviewing him, that he felt... you know, like, hey, if I can handle New York, I can handle Baghdad?
I don't know whether he felt he was really up to the job. He, in fact, wasn't up to the job. He did, in my interview, display an impressive practical street sense. When he sees something right in front of him, he can sort of take it as a fact and isn't blinded by preconceptions about it. But he was way over his pay grade. I mean, this was a completely, dramatically different situation than he'd ever experienced in his life, and it required people who had experience with these kinds of situations. And there are people who have had experience with post-war occupations and chaotic societies and and establishing order in such societies. And unfortunately, the United States did not call upon any of them or place them in Iraq.
Did you get any sense of his work ethic?
I think that he probably worked hard. So in terms of the number of hours that he put in, I'm sure that he put in a lot of hours. I think he probably frequently put those hours in doing not the most important things. You know, he likes being dramatic. He likes dramatizing himself. And so he would apparently go out on raids with police officers, and perhaps that time would have been better spent trying to persuade the administration to give him the 5,000 police trainers he needed, declare martial law, take many other steps that should have been taken.
My guest on WNYC is Charles Ferguson, director of the documentary No End in Sight about those first few months after the invasion of Iraq. It's now available on DVD. It's been out in the movie theaters from about 6 months ago. He's also author of an upcoming book, also called No End in Sight, Iraq's Descent into Chaos, as he has continued to research this material even after the release of his film. We have a few minutes for phone calls for him or comments, so call 212-433-WNYC if you want to speak to Charles Ferguson right now, 212-433-9692, or post a comment to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. And coming up in a few minutes, we'll talk to one of the leaders of Governor Spitzer's Commission on Higher Education in New York State, which is releasing its report today. They're going to recommend some big changes for SUNY, including letting tuition rise at some SUNY campuses. But 212-433-WNYC to talk to Charles Ferguson right now, 212-433-9692. With all that you've continued to learn since the movie came out, would it be much different on film if you were starting right now?
It would be somewhat different. After the film came out, a number of senior intelligence officers and military officers approached me and said that they had participated in these events, and they offered some very interesting and, for the most part, I have to say, rather depressing new information about what had gone on. And
give me another example of what people came forward and told you.
Well, for example, a very senior military officer who I cannot name, but very, very, very senior, people would know his name, told me that when, first of all, he was told of the plan to purge the Iraqi government of Ba'ath Party members only a few days before the order was issued. He was told it on May 11th when Bremer arrived in Qatar on his way to Baghdad. And when he learned of it, he told Bremer, who was about to take charge of the occupation of Iraq, that this was a disastrous mistake and would result in crippling of the country and alienating the Sunni population. And he also said this directly to the undersecretary, the deputy secretary, and the secretary of defense. And he told them in writing as well as verbally. And they listened to him politely, and they proceeded with their plans.
How did Kerik look back on that? Did he think he was kind of sold a bill of goods by Donald Rumsfeld and the Pentagon as to what his job was going to be and what was doable?
I didn't get that impression. I think that he did realize fairly quickly, and he told me that the Pentagon and the United States in general did not know very much about the police in Iraq, that our intelligence was not very good, our knowledge was very incomplete, and so to a very large extent, he was going to be discovering things from scratch as he went along.
Did he come to feel, this was really crazy, I respect myself, but I was not the man for this job, I didn't know Iraqi culture, I didn't speak Arabic, I didn't know the history of the Iraqi police, anything like that?
Mr. Kerik does not strike me as a modest man who ever underestimates his abilities. Certainly my judgment would be that he was way over his pay grade. I don't know that he ever felt that.
Mike in Astoria, you're on WNYC with Charles Ferguson from No End in Sight. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I was just so impressed with the film. I saw it back in Sundance, and I think it just so clearly presents, you know, a case that I think could be taken to the next level, and I wondered if Charles thought it could possibly be the basis for maybe some war crimes case, or how do we use this evidence to go to the next place?
Well, I personally am very conflicted about the question of whether what occurred in Iraq could or should ever be the basis of any legal proceeding against the people who are in charge of the war. Unfortunately, I think it has to be pointed out, for better and or worse, the United States population did re-elect George Bush in 2004, and the United States Congress did give authorization for the use of military force in Iraq, and many of the things, most of the things in the film were public information at the time that they occurred. Not all of them, but many were. So, unfortunately, I don't know whether it's always possible or appropriate to take what obviously I believe to have been a horrific policy and political and national mistake and turn it into a criminal proceeding.
Ellen in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Excuse me. Hi, Ellen.
Hello. You know, they wanted this chaos to happen because chaos would give them justification to remain in Iraq forever. You know, the looting of the Museum of Antiquities, that in itself was enough to declare martial law about. They still haven't been returned. I believe 15,000 pieces, you know, antique pieces.
Do you think, and I have to say we have another caller who wants to make a similar point, do you think that there is anything to a theory that the U.S. wanted it to go down something like the way it did so it could establish a more permanent presence in Iraq?
No, I don't think so. The initial plan, in fact, that the administration had was to withdraw most of its troops from Iraq by August or September of 2003. The administration had very naive, simplistic ideas of what could be accomplished in Iraq, and it thought that establishing an exile government headed by Ahmed Chalabi and simply, as one of my interviewees put it, taking the Iraqi bureaucracy off the pause button would be enough to permit the country to go forward. And there was this kind of deer-in-the-headlights reaction when the administration began to realize what was actually going on.
Sean in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sean.
Hi. I have a question. I was in Baghdad in September 2003, and a lot of people talked about what happened at the Saddam airport. And I was wondering if your speaker had any comments on that.
What happened at the Saddam airport?
There was a slaughter. The Republican Guard was supposedly slaughtered on the airfield, but they weren't. Supposedly, they were all burned beyond recognition. I've talked to quite a few people about it.
By the invading Americans in those first weeks in March and April.
Yeah, supposedly we went in and then got a lot of fire from the Republican Guard and retreated back across the airfield. The Republican Guard then went after us, and in the process, they were all wiped out sort of simultaneously. I've heard it from a few people, but maybe your guest knows more than I do.
Do you know anything about this alleged incident?
I don't. I know that it occurred. There was...
What occurred?
There was combat at the airport, and United States forces initially, for a short time, had a difficult time securing the airport, and there was a bloody fight. That's all I know.
So we're just about out of time, but you continue to investigate these first few months of the war, and you have a book coming out that follows up on the documentary. There are other, obviously, big picture things that other people are investigating. Why are you so interested in this?
Well, first of all, the book also covers current material, including an evaluation of the current military surge, which was very interesting, actually. But the reason that I continue to investigate the 2003 period is because I think that we will come to look at those months in 2003 as perhaps the most pivotal months of national decision-making that have occurred in the last 50 years. And they were disastrous. But
are there lessons from those months that apply right now?
There certainly are, yes.
Such as?
I think the most important one is listen to people, especially people with direct experience of what's going on.
Charles Ferguson, director of the documentary No End in Sight, now available on DVD, and author of the forthcoming book, No End in Sight, Iraq's Descent into Chaos, which will be released early in 08 by Public Affairs Books. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in a minute. Big changes in store for SUNY, including tuition changes. If a commission appointed by Governor Spitzer gets its way, we'll talk to a lead member of that commission. Stay with us.